was Christmas morning. At our home in the mountains of Idaho was our daughter and her girls, our son, and absent from our home was our middle child, Terry. It was near Christmas mealtime when the telephone rang, and my son Terry answered the phone, and then he motioned me, said, "It's for you, Dad." And I picked up the phone, and a lady's voice asked, "Is this Lyle Albrecht?" "Yes." "Have you a son, Terry, who is in New Hampshire, Vermont?" "Yes." "Well," she said, "I'm very sorry to tell you, your son this morning was in a head-on accident. His back is broken, his right knee is crushed, he has head lacerations and internal injuries, and we're not sure he's going to live." Now, I wish that I could tell you that on that Christmas morning, I was a great paragon of faith and strength. I was not. I found myself that Christmas morning wishing that I had more, better, greater faith. Any of you folks ever been in that position? Did you ever wish you had more faith? Of course, yes. Now, the well-read scripture this morning from Hebrews chapter 11 and the first 8 verses give a definition of faith. In the King James, it says, "The substance of things that are hoped for, the evidence of things that are unseen." And I found myself on that Christmas morning wishing God could have spoken more clearly. What do you mean? Why did you use those misty, nebulous notions and ideas? I found myself wishing that I could, on that morning, take faith in my hands, that it could become empirical, that with the carpenter's wrench, I could unscrew it, take it apart, or with the doctor's scalpel, I could open it up and see the elements out of which faith is made and then begin to build one for myself. Why, Lord, couldn't you have spoken more clearly? And shortly thereafter, I was reading from Matthew's Gospel, chapter 15. I want you to begin to turn there with me right now. Matthew chapter 15, I'd read it oft times before, but on this reading, it seemed to leap from the pages and grab my mind and refuse to let it go. Here in story form, we have all of the elements of a great faith. I'm going to begin to read down at verse 21 and ask you to follow, please, down through and including verse 28. Matthew 15, 21 through 28. "Then Jesus left that place and went over in the coasts of Tyre and Sidon. And look, a Canaanite woman from that area came unto him and cried unto him and said, 'Lord, have mercy on me, thou son of David, for my daughter is grievously vexed with the devil.' And Jesus answered her, not one word. And then the disciples came and said, 'Lord, get rid of her. Send her away. She's a nuisance. She's a problem. Just get rid of her.' But then the woman worshiped him." And that's from the Greek word proskuneo. That means she prostrated herself. She fell on her face. You only did that for deity. She cried out, "Oh Lord, help me." Then Jesus spoke to her and said, "Woman, it's not right for me to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." And then the woman said, "That's true, Lord. Yet even dogs are allowed to eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table." And then Jesus said unto her, "Woman, you have a great faith. Be it even as you wish." And her daughter was healed that very moment. Now we're going to take this story apart, you and I, this morning. And we're going to notice a number of things. First of all, a great faith comes boldly to the throne of God, as the Apostle Paul instructed. And after it comes to the throne of God with boldness, it clings and persists and refuses to be driven away or to give up, even though it seems long ages past. And God himself is silent. Further, we know this. True faith is not necessarily an understanding of Bible teachings and Bible doctrines. The Bible is abundantly clear. This is the first time Jesus has been over into this area. She is a complete stranger to Jesus and to his teachings, basically. And there's something else here. It says about this woman that she was a Canaanite. That means that she belonged to the wrong church. She had her theology all mixed up. That tells me that it's possible to understand in detail the major teachings of the Bible and yet have little, if any, real faith. Biblical understanding is not necessarily synonymous with great faith, and it may well be that the person here in this valley that has the greatest faith is not here this morning or in any other worship, or shall not be tomorrow as well. Great faith, not necessarily associated with great biblical understanding. Now, we're going to take the story apart. And we're going to mix up the events a little bit for the purpose of our study. We're not going to mention them exactly like they're written down in the story. We're going to change them around just a little bit as we see the tests, three, that Jesus applied to the faith of the Syrophoenician woman. Number one, test. Test number one. And this requires, by the way, that you and I make a pastoral call together. These are the kinds of visits that I make very regularly in my ministry of reclamation and church growth. Let's suppose that there was a family that once fellowshipped with us, but for whatever reasons they have slipped away. We could call them non-attenders or irregulars or backsliders. But we're going to go see them. I'm going to take you along with me. And so we ring the doorbell and wait, and the door opens, and I introduce myself. I'm Pastor Lyle. I'm from the church. And this is Bill, who's with me. Could we visit with you for just a minute? Yes, we're going to be invited inside. And for just a little bit, we're going to notice the pictures on the piano. These are your children, your grandchildren. Yes. But ere long, I'm going to get right to the purpose of our visit, and I'm going to say, you know, we're the representatives of the church family. The church has asked us to come as their representative and ask you, please, to come back to church. We miss you down at the church. We miss your fellowship, your friendship. We need you. I can't be the pastor I ought to be without you. On the other hand, whether you recognize it or not, you folks need the church. In this day and time, we need to come together and encourage one another and strengthen one another. Won't you please come back? And now if you're watching closely, you'll see what I have seen scores and scores of times. Often it begins right about the collar line. An angry red flush moves up to the tips of the earlobes. And simultaneous to that, there is a hard white line that sets across pursed lips. And a moment of silence. And then, like the waters gushing forth from behind the broken dam, it begins to spill out. Preacher, If you knew what the principal did to our daughter down at the church school, you'd understand why we don't go there any longer. And sometimes it's like this. If you knew what the head elder did to us in a real estate transaction, you'd understand why we don't go there any longer. And sometimes, very tragically, it has to do with the pastor. We're not here this morning to whitewash anyone, pastors or teachers or whomever else, because the great tragedy is, if you'll take some time and do some research, you'll discover these folks are telling you the absolute truth. But now, here is the bottom line to this test number one. She comes boldly to Jesus, states her claim, and then the disciples move in on her. Get rid of her, Lord. She's nothing but a nuisance. Send her packing. She's in our way. Now, let me tell you this. Here we have 12 ordained preachers trying to run this Syrophoenician woman off, and she refuses to budge. You know, my dears, if we have our faith in God, all of the church leaders, ordained or not, all of the folks in the congregation, all of the powers of earth and hell combined, cannot move us from our God, from His temple, from His people. When I came here, I came to stay. You couldn't drive me off with a club. I have come to stay. By the way, if human beings upset us, discourage us, our faith has been misplaced. We've had it in them instead of in our Lord Jesus. Now, test number two. And this, I believe, is the greatest test that ever comes to any Christian. And from here, I have taken my sermon title, The Silence of God. She comes boldly, and she states her case, makes her request. And by the way, note, it's not a selfish request. She's not asking for a new home or even the ability to pay the bills. She's not asking for new appliances in her kitchen. She says, Lord, it's my daughter. It has nothing to do with me, really, personally, except for my own peace and comfort of my mind. It's my daughter, and she's demon-possessed. And Jesus answered her how much? Not one word. Surely you've had the experience. I have. You go to bed one night, and it seems the weight of the world is crushing you down. Maybe it has to do with your boss or something at the workplace. Maybe it has to do with one of the kids, a teenager. Maybe it has to do with your spouse. And you toss and you turn between the sheets. And when all others are peacefully sleeping, you slip from between the sheets and go to some quiet place, perhaps in the basement, and there you fall upon your knees and you begin to pray and perhaps weep. Oh, God, help me. I don't know how much longer I can carry this. Please, Lord. I mean, I'm not necessarily asking for a miracle tonight, but could you at least send me some comfort? Could you at least assure me of your presence? You're with me in this thing. Speak to my heart by morning. And the morning sun begins to light the eastern sky, and it seems that your prayers have gone no higher than the roof overhead. The heavens have turned to brass, and God is silent. Think with me for a little bit about John the Baptizer. If ever there was a man that was confident about his message and his mission, it was John the Baptist. You remember some folks went out to listen to him and meet him, and they came back really surprised. They said to Jesus, we weren't expecting what we found out there. I mean, this guy is something else. Yeah, Jesus said he's probably the greatest he's ever been till now. What'd you expect you'd find out there? Some willy-nilly, namby-pamby milquetoast that's blown by every prevailing breeze? No. If ever there was a man certain of his message, it is John the Baptist. Now, we're going to visit him 6 weeks after this first meeting, and we find him down at the jail, for Herod has made him prisoner. And so on Sabbath afternoon, we go to make a friendly jail visit. And we ask the jailer for permission. Yes, he says, go down the main hallway, turn to the left, go to the end cell, and there on your right you'll... And so we walk down the cobblestone walkway, and we come to the cell. And as our eyes become accustomed to semi-darkness, we see him over in the corner, huddled on a bench. John, get up. Come on over. We want to visit with you. Come on over. And slowly he raises himself. With stooped shoulders, he walks across the cobblestones, grips the bars that separate us, puts his long face between, and we ask him, John, how are things going? How's your courage, man? And John said, well, I'm going to be honest with you. Not great. Especially with my background, a man who spent years and years and years living in the outdoors, sleeping beneath the stars, and free as a bird, to be caged here like an animal in this hole. It's not easy. And then he asks of us the question, but how are things going with Jesus? Oh, John, we wish you could have been with us. Just a couple of weeks ago, we were up in the Galilee area there, and the word got out, and the crowds began to come, and they came, and they came, in droves they came. And finally, the press was so great, Jesus had to get in a boat and push off, and the folks wouldn't leave. They stayed and stayed, and children were getting hungry, and others were getting tired, but they stayed, couldn't get enough. And then Jesus fed them miraculously, and still they stayed. And now everywhere we go, his fame precedes him, and we're having huge attendances at our meetings. Huge crowds are coming. But wait a minute. Why, John, are you asking us these kinds of questions? Surely Jesus has been here to visit you. He's been here, hasn't he? And John says, no. I've seen nothing of him. He hasn't had the courtesy to send me one postcard. And then he asks of us a favor. Go to Jesus. And ask him for me. Are you really the Messiah? Or shall we, what? Shall we look for another one? You see, my dears, in a matter of 6 short weeks, we have seen the corrosion of a great faith when put to the acid test of the silence of God. I believe this is the final and great test that Jesus faced. Never ceases to amaze me how Jesus can come through this gate of the city before he exits through that. He's opened every blinded eye, comforted every hurting heart, blessed every baby, straightened every twisted, withered limb. And yet outside that gate, they're waiting with stones in hand to take his life. He never complains. And then you follow him to that farce of a trial. The Sanhedrin, they have hired liars to come in and tell their lies against him. He stands without an attorney, says nothing. No complaint. And then he's dragged over to Pilate and beaten senseless. And a heavy cross is placed upon bruised and bleeding shoulders. And he begins to drag it up Via Dolorosa to the final place of execution. And while two others are struggling, trying to break free and smack those Roman soldiers in the face, Jesus of his own volition walks to his cross, lays down upon it, and in cadence with the ring of the hammer upon the nail, he's praying, forgive them, Father. They don't know what they're doing. They don't understand. How such calm? Why no complaint? From his earliest years and throughout his ministry, there has been that clear channel of communication between himself and his Holy Father. And up and down that stairway between himself and the Father, angels have ascended and descended and succored and supported and lifted him up. But now, As God the Father looks down on his Son after the cross is raised, he doesn't see the sweet, perfect, sinless Jesus. Rather, what he sees is every vile man, every criminal, every murderer, every rapist of a child. That's what he sees in Jesus. And the Father says, I hate sin so much that if my Son is involved even vicariously, I'll have nothing to do with it. And God slammed the door of communication. He turned his back and walked away. And now we hear the only complaint ever to come from the mouth of Jesus. My God, why have you forsaken me? But Jesus passed the test. The scripture we Adventists love, we referenced it last night. Speaking of the last days, here are they that keep the commandments and have what else? The faith of Jesus Christ. Do we really? Test number three. And before I go further, I need to say to you that what Jesus does now, he takes no pleasure in. Hates to do it. But to further strengthen the faith of the lady, and perhaps more importantly, to teach his disciples a very needed lesson, Jesus speaks like this. Woman, it's not right for me to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. Now, what he's saying is, I'd like to remind you, lady, you live on the wrong side of the tracks. The color of your skin is the wrong color. I owe you nothing. Actually, we ought not be even having this conversation. And now, by the way, when these words of prejudice come from the mouth of Jesus, it's shock therapy for the disciples, and they see that seed in their own hearts. You come from the wrong race. Now, depending upon her own inner makeup, we would expect one of two immediate reactions. If she's the shy, timorous type, we'd expect that she would pull her shawl up to hide her blush, find the nearest opening in the crowd, and beat a hasty retreat, get as far away as possible and as quickly as she could. Or if, on the other hand, she is a more modern lady, a lady from our time and place, we might expect her to square her shoulders and say, listen, Jesus, you can't discriminate against me because of my birthplace or the color of my skin or my background. You can't do that. You can't discriminate against me because I'm a woman. Haven't you heard of the Equal Rights Amendment and women's liberation? You can't do this to me. But instead of taking either of those approaches, the woman, after Jesus said, I don't owe you a thing, she agrees with him. That's right, Lord. How are you going to argue with someone that agrees with you? My Peggy does this to me all the time. I'm sure you're right, dear. You always are. I'm sure you're right. By the way, you were supposed to turn back there at that exit. It's true, Lord. You don't owe me anything. But I've heard such good things about you. You're right when you say that I'm a dog. And by the way, when Jesus said, you know, that I'm not to throw the food, children's food, to dogs, he wasn't talking about those cute little lap poodles and that sort of thing. He's talking about the mangy curs that run the alleys and eat out of the garbage and have sores all over them. She said, it's true, Lord. That's what I am. But couldn't you drop me just a crumb? And now, says Jesus. You passed all three tests. Great is your faith. Let it be just as you wish. And her daughter was instantly healed. What do we learn from the experience of Jesus in the Syrophoenician? Jesus upon the cross, John the Baptist. What do we learn? This certainly. If in that dark hour, when it seems our world is collapsing all around us, and we've talked with our family members and they don't seem to understand, we've gone to our best friend, and our best friend seems to turn to us a deaf ear. We go to church at prayer meeting and we bear our souls to our own embarrassment and we ask, could you please pray for me? And the folks at church seem to care less than our family or our friend. And with no other place to go, we go to the court of final appeal, that dark corner, that private place. And there on our knees and through our tears, we cry out, oh Lord, help me. By morning, please comfort me. And it seems that God is silent if we still now will reach up with both our spiritual hands and take hold of that unseen hand and hang on and cling, persist, even though it seems long ages pass and God has not spoken. Then it'll be said of us as well, great is your faith. Be it as you wish. Have faith in God, though sometimes you must weep. Have faith in God when sorrow pains you deep. Have faith in God, for his promises he'll keep. Have faith, dear heart, in God. Now sing with me, my faith looks up to thee.
Will you please stand with us as we sing our dedication hymn, hymn number 517, My Faith Looks Up to Thee.